Something is trying to get inside my body.
And you want to sleep with me.
We can't go to camp without our physicals now, can we?
La plume de matante.
I take great relish in savoring each separate horror. I roll them over on my tongue.
Don't, Lord Byron. Don't remind me of it tonight.
Sometimes I have wondered whether life wouldn't be much more amusing if we were all devils.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Yes, I've always dreamed of a little girl just like you.
Welcome to Screaming Queens, the horror podcast with a queer eye view. My name's John Larkin, and I'm joined by Stephen Moore, Martin Fennerty, Stephen Blundell, and our token heterosexual, Jonathan Butler. On this episode, we're talking Hammer Horror. There's nothing quite so British as a Hammer Horror. It's up there with a bawdy Blackpool postcard, with a cup of tea, with a carry-on film, and they've always appealed to a queer audience because of the sheer campness, the colour, the humour imbued in many of them.
This is the story of Dracula, a creature who destroys all whom he touches.
You must help me. You must. You're my only hope. You must.
This is not Lucy, the sister you loved. It's only a shell, possessed and corrupted by the evil of Dracula.
Oh, God, have mercy on this poor, unfortunate creature. She is a child of the devil. But we ask thee, in thy great goodness, to save her soul.
Do you believe in evil? As an idea? Do you believe in the power of darkness?
That's a superstition.
Now, there you are wrong. The power of darkness is more than just a superstition. It is a living force which can be tapped at any given moment of the night.
The devil himself.
No coffin could ever hold him. No door could ever bar his way. He is back from the dead.
Count Dracula is alive.
Christopher Lee, Dracula has risen from the grave.
I know Stephen Blundell's as much a Hammer nerd as I am, so let's start with you, Stephen. If I say the words Hammer Horror to you, what comes to mind?
Today, I think the word that would come to mind would be cosy. There's something cosy about them, by today's standards. Even when I was a child, they were very tame, and I used to love watching them over and over again, but I think there's... I don't know how to describe it, really, but they are... I think they're kind of cosy and warm. I don't know if that's a feeling shared by everybody else. But...
when I watch them, I get transported back to being a kid and stuff. When I was younger, I used to... I was obsessed with horror from a young age. The Hammer Horrors were the ones that my dad would let me watch. They'd always be on a Friday or a Saturday night, wouldn't they? Like midnight or something. And I shouldn't have been up that late, so my dad would be saying, go to bed. And they'd be like, oh, just let me watch the end of this one and all that. My abiding memory is dozing off, like falling asleep, pretending I didn't want to miss anything, I didn't want to go to bed, but I was absolutely shattered. So I'd fall asleep on the couch and I'd sort of drift off and my eyes would be closed, but I could still hear it. So I'd fall asleep, listen to the sounds of Christopher Lee's voice and Peter Cushing and...
The study of these creatures has been my life's work. I've carried out research with some of the greatest authorities in Europe, and yet we've only just scratched the surface. Victims consciously detest being dominated by vampirism, but are unable to relinquish the practice. Ultimately, death results from loss of blood. But unlike normal death, no peace manifests itself, for they enter into the fearful state of the undead.
When did Hammer actually stop? Because this is before my time, I'd like to say.
Well, the last film was 76.
Yeah, well, before my time then.
Yeah.
Gosh, I would have assumed it was later than that.
No.
I thought it was 80s.
Well, no, but they carried on with the series, didn't they? The Hammer House of Horror was the 80s, I think.
Yeah, it was like
80, 1980, 81,
wasn't it?
Yeah, but the last film, was 76, To the Devil, a Daughter. The first Hammer, and we're talking horror films here, you know.
Didn't they do Sherlock Holmes? Was Hound of Baskervilles?
Yeah, that was Hammer, yeah. But the first actual full-blooded, full-colour Technicolor horror movie was Curse of Frankenstein in 1957, which still scares the shit out of me today, which is so funny because they are really tame, but there's something about Christopher Lee's makeup in that film. Because when you watch the Boris Karloff Frankensteins, they are scared. There's a scary element to them, the gothic and stuff, but he's very sympathetic, I think, Boris Karloff.
Boris Karloff's really, really kind of nice. He is completely the hair in that film.
Well, you feel,
weird, right?
You feel like sorry him. For him because the doctor's the baddie, really, isn't he? You know, Dr. Frankenstein.
He's just taken out of the wrong place. So I didn't find that remotely scary. I find it amazing and interesting, but not scary.
Yeah,
Frankenstein's tragedy as it is a horror.
Yeah. Whereas Christopher Lee lumbering about with that white face. There's like an image. There's an image where he's looking through a skylight and it's all black and you just see this white face come peering through. And to this day, I can't walk past a trapdoor, you know, the loft trapdoor without imagining it being open and this white fucking face looking down at me. At the same time as being cosy, I agree with you on that, but there's still a fear. Childhood.
I think this is just a familiarity thing that I'm talking about. And I've only seen The Curse of Frankenstein once. I watched it with you, I think, earlier this year.
Yeah, because they've all been, I mean, a lot of them have been brought out on Blu-ray, so they've done an amazing remastering job on them. Because the colours, that's the thing, isn't it? With the Hammer films, that not the black and white ones, obviously, but the colour ones, the colours popped, and they're amazing. But Jonathan, Mr. Butler, Hammer horror of choice, but
my favourite, I think, it was probably Abominable Snowman,
which isn't colour.
No, it's not colour. It's a black and white one. I think it's quite early as well. So.
A small band of men on a perilous search for the man beast of Tibet, the abominable snowman of the Himalayas. You've heard of him, haven't you? The world's most shocking monster. No one's ever lived who's seen him. Be on your guard. He's coming to this theater. The abominable snowman dares you. We dare you. Dare you to see the abominable snowman of the Himalayas.
It's an interesting film because when you think of Hammer, you think of the monsters and it's, you know, the Mummy and Frankenstein and Dracula. Whereas in that film, the monsters are probably the humans. This expedition heads up to Himalayas to find these yetis that live in the mountains, and in the end Peter Cushing decides that the monsters are actually them. They go up and they destroy everything, so he goes back down the mountain and says, oh, we didn't find anything, it's better to leave them alone. And it's really good. There's a really nice atmosphere. It does actually remind me of The Thing slightly, because it's a very male film. There's no real women, there's no women in the film at all. It's all men. And it's about paranoia, and it's really effective.
I really love the early ones because they almost take horror or threat or just that sense of the atmosphere much more seriously.
Yeah,
and I think the later ones they lose that, but they have their own value. They have their own entertainment value for sure. So I guess sort of one of the later ones I really enjoy is Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde.
Oh God,
it's just really ridiculous in lots of ways.
Yeah.
But I think part of what's cosy about Hammer is how they recreate that in almost a cartoon way. Some of those period dramas, some of those period that sort of Victorian Edwardian era and the London Fogs and all of that sort of time is very cosy and is almost cartoony in a way. And that's almost as eerie as maybe the actual stories themselves.
Yeah, I've got a soft spot for the later films that are not technically as good. The trashier, they're just all sort of tits and ass, basically. I mean, I think it was when did it get that way? It was like end of the '60s, wasn't it? It was like 1970 onwards, because films were coming from America, and not just America, all over the world, where it was all about tits and ass, so Hammer felt like it had to up its game. So basically, people just started to get the tits out all the time. There was more blood, there was more violence.
But they didn't really change. They were the same, but with more blood and more tits. Whereas really, America was giving us The Exorcist and Halloween and The Omen completely different.
Well, they were always British, very, very British, weren't they? You know, and I've been reading up on it.
Lots of lesbians.
Yeah, which is funny because, I mean, one of the ones I've got written down, one of my favourites is The Vampire Lovers, which I've watched about 500 times in the last couple of years. I'm obsessed with it. With Pitt, he just brings out the straight man in me with big tits and a big bush. I was watching it the other night with the commentary on the Blu-ray, and she's adamant that it wasn't about lesbians. It wasn't lesbians. You know, she's saying, you know, vampires are all about love and... needing each other and all that, and it wasn't about. I didn't see any lesbianism in that film. Well, she's, you know, rubbing her tits on the poor girl, and the writer and director as well about saying the same thing. You know, they tagged that lesbian thing on afterwards. We didn't know it was about that, and come off it.
You know. An accidentally makes a lesbian
I wonder how much direction they were given from, you know, the film distribution company. You know, was it a requirement to have all this sex and gore in the film?
I think it...
To appeal to audiences?
I think it mirrors the British film industry at that time, because actually the quality of British films in many ways in the 70s deteriorated, and lots of what was being produced was very exploitative. It was about tits and sex. You know, there was the whole Confessions of a Window Cleaner, plumber, or whatever. Absolutely rubbish films, which were just there to titillate. And I think even the Carry-Ons sort of descended into that sort of genre, having previously been maybe a bit more musical and a bit more witty and funny in the use of that. So I think British film just, it reached a bit of a low point in some ways.
Lost its innocence a bit.
Wasn't
didn't it?
The last Carry On film was Carry On Emmanuel, so you knew where they were going with that, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And to the Devil Adores It, I mean, you think Hammer sort of started out with Christopher Lee was sort of he was really sort of mysterious and regal and all that, and by the end of it, he was just miserable to be in these films. Basically, you know, he slagged them off. He was quite public about the way he slagged them off.
I wonder why he did them.
For the money, I imagine.
Yeah.
I know, I just thought about, apparently, Peter Cushing, apparently his wife died as he was in the middle of making these films, and he just ended up, he didn't want to think about anything, so he just threw himself into the work. So I don't think it mattered how terrible the films were, he just wanted to get away from his grief, basically, so he just carried on doing that.
There was a really sad story. I was watching, it was on that Vampire Lovers commentary, and they were talking about Peter Cushing's wife died between Vampire Lovers 70 and Twins of Evil 71, so it was that year. I think it was the director said that he'd walked past Peter Cushing's dressing room and think he was reciting his lines, and then he'd look in and he was actually talking to his dead wife. He sort of studied spiritualism and stuff to be closer to her and all that, so it was really sad. So I think, he was just looking for any kind of distraction, really. So you're more of a Dracula person, Blundell?
Yeah, because I just used to watch them over and over again when I was a child. I have obviously seen a lot more, but that's what got me interested in horror films, and they're the ones I love, really.
Have you got a favourite Dracula?
Probably Dracula, Prince of Darkness.
It's quite grisly as well. Guy getting his throat cut, and that's how they bring Dracula back to life, isn't it?
Yeah.
Cut his throat, string him up like a pig and bleed him out. Yeah. My favourite Dracula is Scars of Dracula, and it's one of the weakest ones, but it's got that camp value of, they had no money, so I think the budget was really rubbish. I think they made it back to back with the one before.
Weren't they making, they were basically making two at a time, weren't they? They were sharing cast and crew, and you'd make it two at a time.
And sets.
Yeah.
One of the
big funny things that we do, I mean, we've done it together, haven't we? Where you watch different Hammer movies and you can pick up the same set that's just been dressed in it.
Redress. I mean, I love them all. I was talking yesterday with Ben about Dracula AD 72, which, as far as I'm aware, was completely panned and ridiculed, but I absolutely love it.
Who knows about vampires, for God's sake?
My grandfather died fighting a vampire.
most terrible, the most dangerous vampire of all time.
No!
The year is 1972. A leap year in horror. A vintage year for vampires.
Count Dracula!
A time for the masters of horror to meet again in the 20th century.
There's too many dreams. I got buried on the side. And that's too little time for the saddle.
The nightmare's over.
I have returned to destroy you.
It's ridiculous, but I just love it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people enjoy it. I think it's become a cult favourite.
Yeah. It's got Stephanie Beecham in it as well, which gives it extra camp value, doesn't it? Yeah. Stephanie Beecham jiggling her tits about. Yeah, and but it was funny because it was set in the 70s, but it was all written like it was set in the 60s. So yeah. even by 72 standards, it was out of date, which is quite funny. And
well, it says it all, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I think we're the only genre that actually truly appreciates the bad with the good. So you can have a film that is technically atrocious, appalling acting, appalling like themes and effects, but for some reason it's adored. I think even more when you go into like the kind of camper side of things and the gay appreciation of it, I think it's another big draw that we like, the fact that things are so over the top and dramatic and you can be so bad in every way but still draw you in, and you get that kind of cult following to that film. And I think it's pretty unique. I think only horror and maybe comedy kind of have those.
We embrace it, don't we?
Yeah.
If something's a bit silly, we just embrace it and laugh along and then enjoy it.
Yeah, in celebration of that.
And I think we have a bit more, we can have a bit more of a sophisticated insight into it, because sometimes that will be completely dismissed, but actually we can take sometimes the value that there is in that over dramatic or melodramatic or...
Is that us as horror fans or queer horror fans? Or
I think it's queer horror fans.
Yeah.
And maybe not solely queer horror fans, but I think there's maybe we're more, maybe you have to be particularly attuned to it sometimes just to sort of get the value of it.
Because you pick up on it as well, don't you, John?
Yeah, I always struggle with this thing of like the camp value of something. Because when I watch Plan 9, people talk about being camp, but I genuinely think at the time Ed Wood didn't see it as camp. He was deadly serious, which maybe makes it even more camp. I don't know. I genuinely don't know.
Yeah,
I think it is. I think if you take something deadly serious and comes off as camp, it's a lot more effective than if you mean to be camp when you set out to be it.
Yeah,
I don't think it has the same effect.
Yeah, sometimes when something's a bit too knowing, it gets a bit annoying, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, like I think the Grindhouse ones, that Planet Terror. And it was designed to be kind of, you know, we're going to make a bad film. And all he did was make a bad film. Whereas, you know, I don't think Fulci or anyone ever set out to make a genuinely bad film. They were deadly serious. They wanted it to be a good film. It just wasn't.
Yeah.
But you can appreciate that.
It's like, not to get off the subject, but like if you look at Showgirls, the perfect storm of bad movie camp. And, you know, he set out. Verhoeven set out to make, he thought he was making a very important film. I mean, he did in a way. But yeah, I don't think anyone in Hammer sat down and thought, right, we're going to make a really camp film, did they? And I suppose it's of its time. It's when you're looking back at that sort of finished product and you just reappreciate it for the retro value as well as the sort of nostalgia of it all and the cosiness, like you were saying. It's funny, isn't it, when I think about, when I hear about a studio in decline, I watch the films from the decline era. I'm like, right, so I want to watch the crap ones. Even the crap ones are fun.
Because they've learned that, because they almost did that, once they're in decline, they've learned so much from what they did well previously. So though the studio might be in decline, it's usually because of other factors. People have moved on to something new, the money's running out, or the budgets for the film are too much for them to get investors. But actually they've learned from making other films beforehand, so those films might be part of a decline. There's something that the past and informs all of that, isn't it?
Yeah, they're good at what they do, but the audiences have moved on. Just like the Carry-Ons. I think it seems Hammer and the Carry-Ons had about a 20-year shelf life, didn't they? And if you go, if you watch them from the beginning to the end,
you can almost pinpoint the spot where it starts to decline and the quality.
Can you pinpoint it on Hammer?
If you start looking at when like the American horror comes out, like Black Christmas is what, early 70s, 74. So you've got a bit of overlaps here. So while Hammer is still trying to churn out, you know, Frankenstein and Dracula, people have moved on to, you know, far grislier things.
Yeah.
And I think you can try and hold on as much as you want, but if the audience is gone, it won't matter.
You have to put in the context of what was happening in the country at that time, and your American film industry was still relatively strong. What, I suppose, compared to the studio system in the 50s and the 40s, was actually relatively gone through a bit of decline itself. But Britain went through a hard time in the 70s. You know, there were power cuts, so people reduced to working 3 days a week, 3 day week. So yeah, the context that those films were made in was quite turbulent times. So there's going to be an impact on that industry anyway, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. What I found interesting about the later ones is there was less of an attention to little details. Like, I'm not saying that the 50s and 60s films were really historically accurate, because we all know they weren't. But when you look at, like, going back to The Vampire Lovers, you know, it's so funny because there's scenes in that where you can see like a tennis court and a chainmail fence in the background, and you can see where the wigs join, and you know, and at one point Ingrid Pitt's wearing a bobble in her hair, and it's like set in like 19th century. You know,
I think at that point it was the studio just needed the money, so it was literally churn the films out as much as we're literally hanging on. Get the films out as fast as you can. Like the 70, 71, just like three films out a year there. So it's just a fast turnover. The studio just needs the money, basically.
And they put some of them out in double bills as well on the cinema, didn't they? So people would go to a double bill, like to a matinee, to watch the two films back to back. You know, so they'd say, oh, we just turn them out as a double. Whereas I suppose as the 70s drew on and got later, people were getting videos, so it's the video nasty thing, you know.
That's when you asked what year, it seems to me that the decade brought about a change in the way the films were created. I mean, when you talked about the film we saw, what was the film with the fence, the mesh fencing?
Vampire Lovers.
I mean, that's really lazy, isn't it? Yeah. So, how, you know, what changed? I mean, I'm thinking about a year or two before that was another one of the Dracula films. I think it was the third Christopher Lee one, Dracula Has Risen From the Grave, which I wouldn't put within that group of 70s titty films. They hadn't quite reached that point, but it was only around the corner.
Yeah.
Now, that could be full of all kinds of mistakes, I'm not sure. But it just seems that they really took their, you know, finger off the pulse and didn't give a lot of attention to detail.
Yeah, but I think I like those later ones for the camp value of, you know, Vampire Lovers, Ingrid Pitt, obviously, Kate O'Mara's in it, who went on to be in, Triangle and Dynasty.
Come with us, if you dare, into a twilight world of unspeakable horror.
You must die. Everybody must die.
Sample, if you dare, the deadly passion of the vampire lovers. Perverted creatures of the night find their victims everywhere. The unsuspecting merrymakers in glittering ballrooms with their young and tender throats. The sleeping beauties whose troubled dreams turn into real, terrifying nightmares.
It was a cat! A huge cat!
For God's sake, save her!
Twins of Evil and the Vampire Circus, which have got two of the campest counts ever. these over-the-top men with bad makeup and, you know, and Twins of Evil especially has got one of the worst sex scenes I've ever seen in my life, which is amazing to watch with, where Carmilla, who's Ingrid Pitt in The Vampire Lover, she's played by someone else in Twins of Evil, but she's resurrected and the first thing she decides to do is have sex with the count, who's not Count Dracula, he's Count something else.
He's very attractive, isn't he, him? black hair.
Yeah, yeah, but very calm. But
that's why I like him.
Yes, yes. This is just a big queen, basically, but he has sex with this woman, and they zoom in on the silhouette, and there's a silhouette of a wanking off a candle. Oh no, it's not a silhouette.
Yeah.
The silhouette of them having sex, but then you just see her hand reach up, and she suggestively wanks the candle off to show that they're having sex, and it's just, like, unbelievable.
I thought I hadn't seen that film, and you saying that seems reminded me of how that's faded in your memory.
Yeah. Tried to block it out.
Yeah. And there's a great line in it as well, where Peter Cushing's, like, the he's a sort of witch hunter. He's, like, at, what's the word? He's a Puritan type, puritanical. Mm-hmm. And his two nieces turn up, and they were, like, Playboy twin centrefolds, basically. And they turn up, and they both turn up with these, like, giant cleavages with feathers, and he says, what plumage is this?
Oh, look. That must be Karlstein Castle. It's beautiful. Just like a fairy tale. Whoever owns that must be rich. Who lives there?
Count Karnstein.
Count Karnstein.
Perhaps you'd like to go to your room now and change.
Change?
Your uncle will be back soon.
Of course. You'd like us to look our best.
Oh, no. I mean, yes. Well, that is, we do things differently from Venice, you see.
No, I don't see at all.
What I mean is that had you lived in Karnstein, you would still be wearing black.
Why? But Aunt Kathy, it's not lack of respect. We wore black for more than 2 months. Until last week.
We do things differently here. Your uncle wouldn't like it. He's a very religious man.
We didn't bring any black.
What kind of plumage is this?
That alone is worth watching the film for.
I'm sold on this one, then.
Yeah, yeah.
Which one was that? Twins of Evil.
Yeah. Because there was a trilogy that they made about this vampire
Lust
family.
Lust for Vampires, the other one.
Yeah, yeah, but... Twins of Evil is probably technically the strongest.
Is that the one, the trilogy that's all set in the same country or region, like Karnstein or something?
Somewhere like that, where they're all sort of Cockney.
But it's like Eastern Europe.
Yeah, Eastern Europe in the 19th century, but they're all like played by Michael Ripper, aren't they? They're all like Cockney sparrows with big tits. But yeah, there's the three of them, Vampire Lovers, Lust for a Vampire, which is the worst, and Twins of Evil. Lust for a Vampire has got like a theme song as well.
All horror films use a theme song.
Yeah, but this is like some woman singing about strange love. While she's getting shagged, got her eyes go cross, she gets cross-eyed to show that she's having an orgasm.
You mean yours don't?
Oh, my legs crossed, but not my eyes. Although Satanic Rites of Dracula is particularly bad, that's quite crap. But Joanna Lumley's in it though, so anyway.
Yeah, you see that now, that just doesn't have the appeal for some reason that 72 does.
Have you not seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it many times, leaves me cold.
Isn't he like a property developer? Isn't Dracula like a real estate?
Yeah, it's utterly ridiculous.
Yeah. Buying up London or something. It's topical, isn't it? It's happening now.
But that's part of the story of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yes, you're right.
Buying
up
bits of property in London.
Yeah, because isn't Jonathan Harker he works for like a real estate because Dracula wants to buy a house in that region.
That's right. Yeah.
Perhaps they should remake it.
Yeah, stands corrected. Actually, do you know what? A couple of those later films are quite respectful to the book, aren't they? They sort of go back to the book because Scars of Dracula was the first time you saw him climbing up the walls of the castle, which he did. He did in the book. Scars of Dracula stands out because it's got Anoushka Hempel. She's in it. It was one of her starring roles, and she's got big, massive tits, and she has sex with protagonist who, even though it's set in 18th century Transylvania, wears 70s red briefs.
Oh, yeah.
Which you only get a glimpse of, but it's enough.
I wanted to ask Stephen, because he's not familiar, Stephen Moore, because he's not familiar with the old Hammer, but I think he's more familiar with the resurgence of Hammer than we are, what his impression of it was, because he was talking about it a bit earlier. And I quite liked The Woman in Black. I'm a sucker for a cheap scare, and I'm unashamed about that. I love sophisticated horror, I love all of that. But I think I'm unashamed of that. But you've got a particular take on that resurgence. It's interesting to hear.
Well, with Women in Black, I genuinely despise that film. I think going into it and hearing all the reviews and hearing from people I knew, once again, everyone set me up for a fall. Everyone was talking about how scary it was. And I got in there and it was jump scare, jump scare, jump scare, jump scare. It was an alright story, kind of weaved in between it, but it wasn't fully explained. It wasn't dark enough. It just kind of felt, the gothicness of it was disingenuous. It wasn't real. It didn't kind of give me that sense of actual gothicness. I felt like someone in the 2010 making a gothic film. Do you know what I mean? There was no kind of sense of actually being in that era. I didn't believe it. And I don't know if part of it was Daniel Craig, because I absolutely love Daniel Craig, but...
Daniel Craig.
Harry Potter.
Daniel Radcliffe.
Radcliffe.
Close enough.
We've actually seen the alternate version starring Daniel Craig. He made it just after Casino Royale, was it?
Yeah.
Using the same swimming trunks.
Yes, he comes up out of the marshlands.
Now you see, I would like that version. That would have been much better.
Covered in leeches.
Yeah.
No, I just didn't appreciate it at all. I thought it was cheap. But then I saw one of the other ones, Wakewood, which was a lot more, that felt cheaper and less big studio budget. That felt studio budget. This one felt, what I imagine, like, original Hammers. Well,
Wakewood, yeah, I've got mixed feelings on it, but...
I wasn't enthralled.
But that's, Wakewood is closer to the original Hammers.
That's how I felt when I watched it. Like, definitely. I felt like it was a cheaper B-movie kind of feel.
Yeah.
But then it also felt like it was a lot more genuine. It was telling its own story that was a lot more... Very strange, but it was a lot more genuine to how I kind of felt. Like, I felt like there was an actual story there. It wasn't cheap.
Yeah.
It was trying to tell me something.
Have you seen Wakewood, Steve?
No, I haven't.
Have you seen Wakewood?
No, not yet. Have
you seen Wakewood?
No. That's why I wanted to hear from Steve, just to hear more of that.
And Aidan Gillen's in it, isn't he? He was Stuart in Queer as Folk.
Yeah.
I remember the good scene with the child getting mauled by a dog.
Yeah.
That was quite pleasurable to watch, really. Yeah, quite satisfying.
I still wait for that day in Walking Dead when they finally kill off the kids.
Yeah.
I'm hoping they kill off the babies soon.
still alive, bloody hell.
Brides of Dracula. Am I right in thinking they couldn't get Christopher Lee?
Yeah.
He was not available, and that's why they came up with this different character. But I've read
in... And boy, is she different.
I remember reading about the actor. Do we know his name? Well, whoever he was, I read somewhere that he was a confirmed bachelor. We all know what that means, don't we? And there's I read somewhere in a book commentary of horror films about there's a line where the Baroness or whoever she is says, the Baroness says, oh, we used to have such gay times.
Yes.
And it seems to me to have been pounced upon, but I'm not sure that people are reading a bit too much into it.
Well, she herself was a fierce, flawless queen, the Baroness. She's like, she's the, well, the film's about, she's a French teacher, isn't she, who goes to the middle of, let's call it Carpathia, to teach at a girls' school, obviously, as they all do. And she ends up stranded and has to take refuge in this castle. The Baron Meister, she meets his mum, and she's like, you would think she was born male genitalia. She's a very deep voice and 10 foot tall in this big cape, and she just floats about the place. She's an actress called Martita Hunt, and she's
why?
That's it. She goes why? Into the Cockney Inn, doesn't she, in the middle of Germany or whatever? And
why?
and she takes, anyway, she takes the girl home, and she says, oh, you know, don't go into the West Wing, don't go in there, and that's where the son is, and he's chained to the wall because he's not like the other boys. And he's as camp as old tits. That's great, isn't it? The Brides of Dracula, that's one of those films that looks amazing. The colours in it are just
beautiful.
Gorgeous.
And again, it's got that sort of lovely Hammer horror, cosy
that's
feeling.
Definitely got the
cosy I don't know film. If this resonates with anybody, but that's just how I feel about them.
The last one I watched was actually The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
Oh yeah, go for it.
That was towards the end of, I think, as the studio was kind of winding down, and it's kind of telling as I mentioned before, would like carry on and the, you know, going towards the Emmanuel crowd, and so Hammer started moving towards the martial arts vibe that was kicking off at the moment. So it was like a Shaw Brothers Hammer co-production.
Black belt against black magic in the greatest battle of all time. As the seven brothers and their one sister meet Dracula. While vampires drink the blood of the virgins and turn them into zombies. Seen Kung Fu until you've seen the seven brothers and their one sister in action against Dracula.
I don't think it really works, to be fair. I mean, it's different, you know, it's different. He tried, and it's definitely camp.
Yeah. But I remember the like zombified vampires have strange masks on.
Yeah, all they have the seven golden vampires. Although at no point in the film is there ever seven, because one of them's already dead at the start of the film. Yeah. So there's only ever six. And then the first time they attack Van Helsing, they kill three of them, so there's like three of them.
So it doesn't sound quite as good.
It's not as catchy that the But yeah, so any time they kill anyone, they come back as a zombie. But that was kind of, there's like a Hong Kong like vampire scene for films as well. It's like Mr. Vampire. There's like a series of films there. And it's kind of, the vampires in that are really weird. Like hot and they hop about. And,
sorry.
So we tried to copy that.
Hong Kong zombie vampires.
Yeah, okay. When a studio's in trouble, they need to try and do things. Even Bond, you know, like Live and Let Die. It's the black exploitation was big at the time, so let's put Bond in Harlem and see what sticks. And so, you know, the martial arts was big at the time, so, and you throw Peter Cushing as Van Helsing around China, which was probably actually Wales in reality, wasn't it? All the Chinese people were probably from Liverpool, Chinatown. I'm struggling to even think what the plot was. They're trying to steal. The kidnapping women to, I don't even know what they're doing with them. They've got them tied up at one point with the tits out, and then they don't really seem to do anything with them. It's all a bit confusing.
I personally think you'll never beat the Hammer versions of all of the classics, because do you know how to tackle a big book like Dracula?
You think the Hammer's Dracula is better than like Universal Dracula? Because
yeah.
Really? Because I watched Universal Dracula and I was blown away, so...
The Bela Lugosi?
Yeah, I love Bela Lugosi. I think Bela Lugosi is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, no, he's Oh, he's got his qualities, hasn't he, but...
It's boring. I find it slow. I find it creepy. Boring. Yeah,
it is.
I think so.
It is pretty boring.
I find the Universal Dracula is slow and creaky, and I find the Francis Ford Coppola, Bram Stoker's Dracula to be overblown and overcomplicated, badly acted.
But I actually think that has, for me, in some ways, the same qualities as Hammer Horror. It looks a bit colourful and cartoonish and has the same cosy feel.
Do you think that's because of the time of your life that you watched it? Time in your life that you watched it?
No, even that's how I feel when I watch it now. I would link that to, and there's been so many adaptions of that particular book, but I would link the Bram Stoker film to the Hammer horror films.
I think Keanu Reeves' acting would fit very well in like Hammer horror.
That's very
true. English accent, his whole, it just,
I don't know what you mean. His whole
character, his whole, just the acting of a lot of the actors in that film would fit right into Hammer.
I think Francis Ford Coppola was inspired by, amongst other things, he was inspired by the Hammers, I think. You can sort of tell when you look at it.
Yeah, it's over the top, right. It's camp. Yeah.
But where I think Hammer Dracula succeeded was it simplified the story. They knew what their budgetary restraints were, so they simplified the story to fit to what they could do. And I think that made for a clearer film. And I think that's true of a lot of old horror compared to new horror, is that because they didn't have the budget, they had to be more creative. They had to be more creative with the scripts, they had to be more creative with the design. And
which is, I suppose, where Blumhouse have kind of come out of nowhere, because they've been focusing on taking the smallest budgets you can possibly have and then making these giant hits out of them with Making Tenfold. And I think a lot of the times, sometimes it doesn't work. Paranormal Activity. But then you have things like Insidious and Sinister and these kind of films that have got minuscule budgets and then have made tenfold of them, and not only done that but made actually great horror films.
I think Sinister, I don't like it.
I don't really like any of the new ones. For me, it's like what Hammer did do well. It was, they didn't have much budget, but it was it was the creativity that they had. And I think creativity will always win out over budget.
Yeah.
The horror films you make now, I'd be honest, I'd hate to be like a young person now getting into horror, because I think most of the horror films now are terrible.
I think I was
lucky to be born around the time I was, like the 80s, with all the video nasties. I think that was a brilliant time to be getting into horror.
Yeah.
I take it from a different way, because obviously, to me, I grew up on the kind of things where most people see horror in its decline, like the 90s. Like, the mid-90s was where I started, and then early 2000s. You know, now you get into the jump scare, cheesiness, kind of, a lot of it went nowhere. Now I think we're kind of coming back into horror, getting a little bit more of it. And you've got things like Babadook, which...
Yeah, the Babadook is good.
Got, real credibility. Yeah. There's films out there now that have got real credibility.
Yeah.
You've got things like Cabin in the Woods and things like that, which would actually, again, bring it back. Maybe stealing off Scream and stuff like that.
I don't like Cabin in the Woods.
I like
Cabin in the Woods.
Hated it.
Did you?
Hated it.
But me and Stephen Moore, we're big Buffy fans, aren't we?
Yeah, and it's
like an episode of Buffy.
Yeah, it's a love story to Joss Whedon anyway.
That's probably why we like it, because we're into Buffy and...
I watched Buffy from beginning to end, but I hated Cabin in the Woods.
Hated it.
But I see it retrospectively now. I can appreciate the diamonds that we have now, but then I can also enjoy the fact that I can go back and watch them from the 80s that you have probably been kind of brought up on and used to know that. Whereas I'm going back to seeing it, and to me it's something completely new that I've never heard of. And I like the fact that I'm getting to experience that now at 25. Like, as something completely new.
Yeah.
And as opposed to being a kid and seeing it and just not quite fully understanding what you're watching.
Yeah. I suppose it's easier now, I suppose, because the access is so much better. You can go on YouTube and watch Cannibal Holocaust. So, whereas...
So much on YouTube, you can just watch the whole film.
I remember being a kid when I was probably about 12 or 13, and I had a Dutch copy of Clockwork Orange because it was still unreleased. Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, you wouldn't, people like the people, kids now wouldn't even think of that, would they? And I'm not even that old, and I sound like an old man now.
Yeah.
But even, you know, 20 years ago, the availability still wasn't there.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing that's quite interesting listening to you talk, is that you talk about, staying up late on a Friday night to watch it on the telly. I genuinely remember never watching a horror film on the telly in my life, ever. Everything I've ever watched has been downloaded or watched on DVD or Blu-ray because I've gone into it. Yeah. I've never had that experience of staying up late to watch a film in that way.
I expect no one does anymore.
No, I don't.
I watch horror films now at 9 o'clock in the morning when I wake up, and that's what I think I put on, and the sun's gleaming in through the window, and I'm like, let's watch some gore.
Yeah, shut the curtains. No, it's true. It's true, but I think that's something I do actually miss, is that fun of staying up late and watching a horror movie. Because you can watch it any time now. You know, Sky Movies, you can switch on Sky Movies at 9 o'clock in the morning, and The Conjuring is on every busy morning with Lorraine Kelly. You know, it's either to watch flick between Lorraine and Insidious 3 or something. You know,
I do miss that. It almost feels like there's too much to watch. I mean, I'm glad lots of stuff is accessible, but there's almost too much. There's just it's almost like there's so much to watch that you could never get through it. And I almost miss that lack of availability where you never really knew when you were going to get to see a film.
So actually,
sometimes you were, and so what you were exposed to was thrust upon you. You didn't actually have a choice. I think we probably filter a lot based on what our tastes are, and you maybe miss things that we would otherwise be exposed to if there was less truth.
You know what we need now? Mary Whitehouse. We need her back in our lives to take all of these horrors away from us again. That's what we need.
I love that we're actually talking pro-censorship in horror.
Yeah, it's take it all away.
Isn't that like completely the opposite of what everyone else says?
yeah, take it all away.
Things are always more fun when you have to kick against them.
That's very true. That's very true. Enough about your sex life. So, Hammer, we all love it. Stephen Moore's going to watch more of it.
Yeah.
I'm stacking up my DVDs to give to him on his way out because I've got them all on Blu-ray now, so you can have like Twins of Evil and a few other things.
Now you've said it's better than Universal, I feel like I need to test this.
I've got the American DVD of Dracula. There'll be a way to watch it.
I will find it.
It's probably on YouTube.
Yeah, true.
Are we allowed to say that?
We're allowed to say
whatever we want.
Other streaming services aren't available.
Yeah. So there you have it. Hammer's been described as trashy, camp, funny, scary, and cozy. Do you find it cozy? I definitely do. You always pretty much know what you're going to get with a Hammer. Christopher Lee swishing about in his cape, big boobs, beauties in peril, and in the later films, not much else. And you're always going to get good, triumphant over evil at the end. Apart from in the final film to The Devil, a Daughter, which left a more nihilistic taste in the mouth and echoed the sad, underwhelming death of the studio at the time. As always, we'd love your feedback on the podcast. We're learning as we go along, and we hope you'll stick with us for the journey. Get in touch via email. It's screamingqueens@gmail.com. And next time we'll be talking video nasties and good old Mary Whitehouse, who has a campness all of her own. I'm sure she'd spin in her grave to hear that, so I'll say it as often as possible. See you next time.